From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet one of South Africa's leading novelists, André Brink. He has the distinction of having written the first novel in the Afrikaans language to be censored by the government. Brink has been an Afrikaner dissident, and his new novel is about two Afrikaners planning to assassinate the president. Also, we'll talk with Nicholson Baker about his new novel, Vox. It's one long, erotic, expensive conversation between a man and a woman on a 900-number phone sex line. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Lou Reed's new album, Magic and Loss. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Today, Secretary of State James Baker urged prompt ratification of the Strategic Arms Reduction Agreement, known as START, which would reduce long-range nuclear arsenals in the U.S. and former Soviet Union by about 30%. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Several senators in the Foreign Relations Committee questioned the wisdom of ratifying START at this time. Republican Jesse Helms of North Carolina said now that the Soviet Union has disintegrated, the agreement should be renegotiated with the former Soviet republics. Democrat Joseph Biden of Delaware noted that President Bush and President Yeltsin of Russia have both proposed deeper cuts than those called for in START, and he said START should be amended to reflect those cuts. Secretary Baker responded that the U.S. and Russia have not yet agreed on what the lower level should be, but there is agreement on the terms of START, he said.
And it would be good to lock it in and get it ratified.
On a related issue, Baker found bipartisan support in the Foreign Relations Committee for economic aid to the former Soviet republics. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The naval commander of the Commonwealth of Independent States said today that the CIS and Ukraine are still far from agreement on who owns the former Soviet Black Sea Fleet. The commander, an admiral, blamed Ukraine for the failure of the talks, saying that Ukrainian officials want far more of the fleet than they need for their own defense. Admiral Vladimir Chernavin also said that combat ships and submarines of the former Soviet Navy were being sold abroad, both as scrap metal and for military use. Ukrainian officials said that only the ships with strategic nuclear capability should go to the Commonwealth. They say the rest should go to the Ukrainian Navy. Russian President Boris Yeltsin said that he expects concrete results on nuclear weapons talks during his three-day visit to France. He arrived in Paris this afternoon, where he was greeted by French President François Mitterrand. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Boris Yeltsin was given military honors at the airport and then was flown with President Mitterrand to Paris in a helicopter. The two heads of state met for more than an hour. Afterwards, Yeltsin said they had discussed disarmament and French financing for the dismantling of nuclear weapons in the former Soviet republics. Yeltsin said he expects French support for Russia's economic reforms. He also suggested he would like France to cut its nuclear arsenal. Last week, Yeltsin called on France, China, and Britain to cut their nuclear stockpiles, but that proposal has been rejected by the three countries. Tonight, Yeltsin and his wife are the guests of honor at a dinner at the Palace of Versailles. His visit ends on Friday with the signing of a Franco-Russian treaty. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 15 points to close at 3,257.6. Advances led declines by a margin of 9-7 in heavy trading. This is NPR. White House Chief of Staff Samuel Skinner said today that the administration is planning to rebuild President Bush's approval rating and sell his economic recovery plan to the voters. Skinner told reporters today that the president will travel around the country to explain his program to friendly audiences and pressure Congress to pass it by his March 20th deadline. The White House is also seeking endorsements from business. Skinner said that 68 business groups and associations have declared their support so far, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers. Two Israeli Arabs have reportedly been detained in Egypt on suspicion of espionage. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
Diplomatic and security sources in Cairo say an Israeli Arab and his daughter have been arrested on suspicion of spying for the Jewish state. This is believed to be the first such case since Egypt and Israel signed a peace treaty in 1979. Egyptian security sources reportedly say the pair was taken to a maximum security prison this week amid accusations they had been gathering military information for Israel. The suspects, however, have not yet been formally charged. Both the Egyptian Foreign Ministry and the Israeli embassy say they have not been officially informed of the arrest. However, Israel's ambassador to Egypt is quoted as saying local authorities confirmed the detentions to him after he learned of the arrests from reading the newspaper. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
Venezuelan President Carlos Andres Perez indicated today that he intends to maintain unpopular economic reforms despite yesterday's failed military coup attempt. Venezuela's defense minister laid part of the blame for the coup attempt on the country's economic problems. Military pay has been seriously eroded by inflation. At a meeting today with the head of Venezuela's largest business group, President Andres Perez said that he was committed to austerity measures designed to stem inflation. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The white South African novelist André Brink has been praised and damned in his country. He won South Africa's most prestigious literary award three times, but two of his novels were censored by the government. In fact, Brink's 1974 novel, Looking on Darkness, was the first novel written in the Afrikaans language to be banned by the government. Afrikaans is considered the language of apartheid and the ruling class, but it's also Brink's native tongue. He wrote about becoming an Afrikaner dissident in his book Writing in a State of Siege, a collection of his essays from 1967 to 82. His novel A Dry White Season was adapted into a film of the same name featuring Marlon Brando. Brink's new novel, An Act of Terror, is about two Afrikaners who plan to assassinate the president of South Africa. Brink told me why he wanted to get into the minds of assassins.
I think it was the experience in the course of the 80s of getting closer and closer to a number of people within the ANC, which, as you know, is the main liberation movement in South Africa. I made some of my very, very best friends among them. And this meant having the experience of getting very close to people who at one or other stage in their lives, even if now perhaps they were professors of literature or scholars of music or whatever, had been what the world outside would call terrorists, had actively been involved in violence. And it seemed to me, as a white South African moving among quite a variety of whites, that it was just so easy to brand a person a terrorist without really understanding the forces and motives which drive a person to such an extreme. So I wanted to try and find out for myself what could happen inside a person to drive him or her to that point where he or she believes that violence is simply the only option, and in the process to try and interpret some of these truly wonderful and memorable people to others who did not have the occasion of meeting them personally.
Why did you make your assassins white?
I think it was important for me for a variety of reasons. First of all, to get across to, in the first place, to a number of my own South African compatriots, that violence is not something you associate only with them, with the blacks, with the so-called enemy, that even ordinary, decent, white Christian Afrikaners can reach a point where they believe that violence is the only option. And being white myself, I have a more direct line of communication, as it were, to a white community. And it seemed to me very important to try and reach those people and interpret to them something of what I was privileged to glimpse of the so-called other side.
Have you ever reached the point where you felt you were ready to participate in an act of violence?
I think I've often reached the point where I could deeply understand why people resorted to violence, but I don't think I could ever do it.
Why not?
I'm simply not good enough material for that. I don't have the steel nerves that are required for something like that. And perhaps I have always remained, even in the very dark days, something not of an optimist but not entirely a pessimist, which means that it has always seemed to me that in addition to the possibility of violence, there have always been other possibilities. And to me it seemed imperative that one exhaust everything first before taking that ultimate step.
One of your main characters' fathers is a lawyer. Your father was a magistrate. I wonder what kind of attitude you grew up with toward upholding the laws of apartheid.
I think it was very ambiguous. On the one hand, I grew up in a very traditional, very conservative Afrikaner family in a series of very small villages where attitudes were absolutely as conservative as one could imagine, like the Deep South in America. And, of course, my father, as a magistrate, had to uphold the system. But being born inside it, as a child, even as a student, before I went to Paris and started looking at the world through different eyes, I never really deeply or significantly tried to question the system because I'd never been exposed to any other possibility. At the same time, perhaps, I was fortunate in at least having a father who, even if he had to uphold the system and did do just that, also had an innate sense of justice. He is still one of the most just people I've ever encountered. And I think in both respects this has fed my own interests and tendencies.
What are the pressures on a just man upholding an unjust system?
Oh, they're awful. I don't think my father himself was so conscious of these pressures because, terrible to say, he believed that it was a just system. He believed in the fact that whites were the only civilized people. At the same time, he didn't want to be unjust to the black victims of that system. But I don't think he ever really felt a conflict about that because he believed that apartheid was trying to keep people apart so that each could best fulfill his or her own aspirations. And it's, I think, very hard for many Afrikaners who never have had any exposure to a world beyond that to realize just the enormity of the evil of apartheid. I myself had to leave the country for a few years and live in Europe in order to suddenly discover the full horror of what is being perpetrated there.
When you did discover the horror of apartheid, what kind of split, if any, did that cause in your relationship with your father?
There were enormous consequences. The splits and the breakups really occurred with my friends. With my family, on the whole, we went through a very difficult period. But the love we had within the family relationship in the long run was strong enough to overcome our political differences simply by tacitly agreeing that we would never discuss politics at home.
But with your friends, things were never reconciled?
No, there were some of them who totally rejected me and refused ever to speak to me again, and some of them who chased me out of their homes and forbade me ever to set foot in them again. And that was quite hard because some of them had been very good friends before.
You said it was in Paris that you were awakened to the true meaning of apartheid. Was there a moment of revelation for you? Was it a slower process than that?
I think the main moment had to do with the Sharpeville massacre in 1960. Because of the extreme violence of it and the ripple effects it sent right across the world, and the fact that I wasn't home, I wasn't cushioned or sheltered by all the traditional defense mechanisms, but was exposed to many of my new friends there who viciously turned against me as a South African, as if I were co-responsible for what was happening. And that forced me in a very short time to revisit all the positions I'd taken, to reassess everything I'd always taken for granted. So it was a very profoundly disturbing, but in the long run, very, very rewarding experience.
If you're just joining us, my guest is André Brink. He's a South African writer whose new novel is called An Act of Terror. You were, as I said, the first Afrikaner writer to have a book censored. Was the Afrikaner establishment reluctant to censor one of its own?
For a long time they were. For a long time, I think Afrikaans writers enjoyed a specially privileged position because, however recalcitrant they might be, they were still regarded as members of the family. But once the government had taken that decisive step of acting against one of their so-called own writers, the hunt was open. And then we really had a very, very raw deal. And we discovered gradually that English writers like Nadine Gordimer and others actually had more freedom to express themselves than most Afrikaans writers had because they were regarded as English, therefore as part of the traditional enemy, so what else could one expect of them but attacks? But if attacks came from within the establishment itself, that was really viewed in a very, very harsh light.
What were some of the personal ways that sense of betrayal was expressed to you?
I think it was mainly in the form of a persistent persecution by the security police, because once a book is banned, it's not just the terrible discovery that you are, if you write in a small language like Afrikaans, cut off from your whole readership and therefore are left in the wilderness. But the security police regard you as a subversive element, and it's very much like the dark years of the McCarthy era in America, where you are constantly being followed wherever you go. From time to time, you're called in to be interrogated by the security police, or they suddenly turn up and start searching your house. At one stage, they confiscated even my typewriters to make it difficult for me to type. The whole exercise was focused on making life as difficult as possible in order to intimidate one.
Your first censored book was Looking for Darkness, published in 1974. Did the government give you any sense of what specifically offended them?
Oh, they threw the whole censorship book at me. They said it was subversive, in political terms, aimed at overthrowing the government, and they said it was pornographic, and they said it was blasphemous. Those were the three major counts. Every time a character in the book said, "Oh God, it's hot," or something like that, that was noted down as being blasphemous. And it's weird in retrospect, but it was damn serious right then.
Afrikaans is considered the language of apartheid. How has it affected your feelings about the language? You know, most writers have such a deep affection for the language that they grew up speaking.
That was very difficult at times, because it is my mother tongue, and it is really a marvelous vehicle for expressing oneself in, because it is still so young, it's vital, it's not fossilized in its specific forms yet. You can really sit down and do almost anything with it. But at the same time, I was very, very aware of this political stigma attached to it. But perhaps for that very reason, even though I switched to writing in English alongside of Afrikaans, I never stopped writing in Afrikaans in order to prove that it is not just the language of apartheid, of oppression, of the establishment, but that it can be used by people fighting for liberation, fighting to assert their own individuality through that very language. And I think it has paid off. Nowadays, there are more and more of the so-called colored people in South Africa who also use Afrikaans as their language of revolution and rebellion. And there are more and more of the colored writers using Afrikaans. And they are revitalizing it in a wonderful way.
That's interesting. So what have you been doing for the last few years? You write in both Afrikaans and English?
Yes. Initially, after the ban on Looking on Darkness, it was a matter of writing in Afrikaans and then translating. But gradually, the dual process of writing in two languages has become part of my whole method of operating as a writer. Nowadays, I write in both. I write some chapters in one language and some in another. In an act of terror, where I have a variety of different speakers, I used Afrikaans for some of them and English for others. I wrote the historical section, which forms about a fifth of the book, in English, and much of the rest in Afrikaans, except, as I've said, for some of the different voices speaking. And it gives me a kind of linguistic interaction among the characters, which, of course, in the final version, one cannot communicate. But I think something of it still gets through.
Kind of doubles your work, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. Doubles, trebles, quadruples. But I think it adds, I hope it adds to it in the long run, simply by forcing me to think through everything I say in at least two different languages. And that makes sure that one approaches the kind of clarity you wish for, perhaps a bit more closely than would have been the case otherwise.
If you're just joining us, my guest is South African writer André Brink. His new novel is called An Act of Terror. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I guess the South African novelist André Brink. How is the gradual ending of apartheid changing your place as a writer in South Africa?
In one way, it makes it more difficult. In another, it makes it easier. More difficult in the sense that, ironically perhaps, when you're living in a situation of overt, direct oppression, there is a sense of meaning to what one does. It may be very difficult sometimes to operate, but it gives you that sense of adventure, of doing something which is worthwhile doing. When that pressure eases, and when one's way of working as a writer becomes more and more comparable to the way of working of any writer anywhere else in any free society of the world, then there is that much less reason for readers to take heed of what one is saying, because it's just one book among many others. So that drama of the interaction lessens. And that may be a negative. On the other hand, it may be healthier. One sometimes tends to overstate a case when you are shouting against a blank wall. Now it seems to me that as a result of the changes happening, South African literature generally is opening up, is widening its spectrum. More things can be said about more experiences. One need not feel, not that I think any writer really worthwhile has yielded to that, temptation, but one needn't feel obliged to transmit a message, as it were. You can simply write about, you can write a love story, you can write about anything that interests you, and it is a valid part of human experience. I think that is wonderful. People outside seem to have become used to expecting South African writers to write about apartheid, and that can be a deadening kind of expectation. If one can really write about anything in the human condition, that is wonderful. And that is what has always interested me. I don't regard myself as a political writer, just as little as I think Nadine Gordimer or Ethel Fugard regard themselves as political writers. Politics has formed part of what we do because it is part of our daily lives. It enters the fabric of our existence. But what interests me is what happens to a particular woman, man, child in a specific historical situation. And with apartheid slowly receding, those human experiences can hopefully now be evaluated for what they are.
Well, your new novel, An Act of Terror, is still a political novel. It's still largely about apartheid and two people trying to bring down the system. Do you see a change in your writing coming up?
I was very conscious while I was writing, through the nearly 8 years when I was engrossed in this book, of not only an era in South African history drawing to a close, but of a certain phase in my own writing coming to an end, too. I know that something new is going to happen. I can't define it yet. I'm not into another book yet. I need some time to catch my breath again after the many years working on this one. But I know it's going to be different. The circumstances outside, and I suppose a number of things which have happened inside me, just clamor for something new.
What are some of the ways your day-to-day life has been changing as the apartheid system changes or draws to a gradual close?
I think mainly the fact that, especially throughout the 70s and much of the 80s, when it became known, and as it became known, that I was a dissident writer, that I was fighting in my books against apartheid, more and more of the oppressed, black people, became aware of that. Many of them hadn't even read my books, but they just knew my name as somebody who was fighting against apartheid. And so they would literally come to me for help. If a member of their family had been arrested by the security police, they would come to me to offer some kind of assistance. Or very often, sometimes, simply when somebody was thrown out of his or her house for not being able to pay the rent, they would come to me. So every single day of my life went into trying to help people like this, or to put them in touch with people who could help. And now gradually, with that urgency disappearing slowly, and also with the appearance of organizations like the ANC and others who are tuned to doing that kind of job, it leaves me more free time to pursue my writing. And that is Oh, it was worthwhile being involved in that daily contact with people, but sometimes it was very, very exhausting, and I think this respite may also help my writing.
As the system changes, do you find that your relationship with black South Africans is changing at all?
I think that has become more varied, as it were, because there are more areas in which we can communicate and work together. It is not just in the sense of working together against apartheid. We can simply share that much more as friends. It is easier sometimes simply to sit down and listen to music or watch a play or just talk nonsense, just talk as ordinary human beings do when they get together. So that, in addition to the continuing struggle, because not for a moment must one think that with apartheid slowly leaving the scene, the problems in the country are being solved. So there is still a real sense of a struggle continuing, but at the same time there is a larger scope for ordinary human interaction on the most banal and the most warm and the most ordinary levels, and that is very rewarding.
I have met some writers who felt a responsibility to stay in South Africa to fight the system. They would have felt like they were walking out on it if they had left the country. I wonder if that's what keeps you in South Africa, or if there were other things that have been keeping you there, and if you've ever thought about moving someplace else.
It's a very complicated question, really. As far as those who have left the country are concerned, some of them had no choice. Most of the black writers were driven into exile, some white writers like the poet Breiten Breitenbach, whose wife was regarded as colored because she was Vietnamese and wasn't allowed into South Africa. He also had no choice. But if one had the choice, to me it seemed, and others may have seen it differently, but to me it seemed absolutely important to be on the spot in order to live through what was happening, in order to experience that solidarity with people there who did not have the option of leaving, and to report from the inside, as it were. Oh, there were days when I really thought that there was no point in staying. I'd always taken the view that if the lives of the members of my family were physically endangered to such a point that it was necessary to get out, then I would have to leave. But for as long as it was possible to remain there and to write there where things were happening, it was imperative for me to stay there. Now, of course, the choices are much more open. It wouldn't so matter so much to the developing South African situation whether I'm there or not, but it is so fascinating to be there, to be in the midst of a society which is in the process of redefining itself, of looking for itself, trying to discover who it is and what it can be, that I don't want to leave now. But if one day the attraction of the south of France, which has always been one of my favorite Elysian fields, as it were, becomes so great, then I may leave without a sense of betrayal.
Well, André Brink, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
André Brink's new novel, An Act of Terror, is published by Summit. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Phone sex has been described as the only safe sex in the age of AIDS, but writer Nicholson Baker says even though phone sex can't give you a disease, it can be emotionally dangerous. Baker's new novel, Vox, is a long conversation between a man and a woman arousing each other with their fantasies on a 900-number talk line. We'll talk with him about the book. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Lou Reed's Magic and Loss, an album of 13 songs about disease and death. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN Security Council has once again decided to keep its economic sanctions against Iraq because it says Baghdad has not complied with demands for destroying its weapons arsenal. Officials also said that UN nations strongly deplored Iraq's refusal to continue talks on resuming oil exports. In Washington, President Bush today lashed out at critics of his economic program, calling them gloomsayers, in a speech before a group of small business leaders. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush faces several obstacles in trying to build pressure on Congress to pass his economic program by March 20th. Polls show Americans are split on whether they believe his economic plan will work, and congressional Democrats are pushing alternative proposals. Today, Mr. Bush tried to drum up support for his economic program, a capital gains tax cut, tax breaks for the real estate industry, and he called on Americans to throw off cynicism and fear.
And I'm frankly very tired of the professional pessimists who don't have any fresh ideas for the future and who literally feast on bad times and hard feelings and who talk as if our best days have passed by. They just don't understand.
President Bush will also unveil his health care reform proposals tomorrow. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
In Belfast, Northern Ireland, 5 people were killed and another 10 wounded in an armed attack on a bedding shop in a largely Roman Catholic neighborhood of that city. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
Witnesses say the two men entered the shop shortly after noon and immediately opened fire on the roughly 20 people inside. One man wounded in the leg said it looked like a butcher shop by the time the shooting ended. The two men then escaped in a car driven by an accomplice. The police have made no arrests. The outlawed Ulster Freedom Fighters, a Protestant paramilitary group, claimed responsibility for the attack and said it was in retaliation for an IRA attack last month that killed 8 Protestant construction workers on their way home from a job. Yesterday, 3 people were killed by an off-duty police officer in the Belfast office of Sinn Féin, the legal political wing of the Irish Republican Army. The police officer later committed suicide. Today's attack brings to 27 the number of people killed in sectarian violence this year. All of the dead were civilians. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
Oil production in the former Soviet Union fell sharply last year, dropping more than 1 million barrels a day. The International Energy Agency says that oil production dropped to 10.4 million barrels a day in the former Soviet Union, and exports also had a sharp drop. Production in December was down to its lowest level of the year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 15 points to close at 3,257.60 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali says that he does not advocate sending a peacekeeping force of some 10,000 people to Yugoslavia at the present time. The UN Secretary General says that there are still no assurances that the various factions in the current unrest will cooperate if a large deployment is made. At present, there are 50 UN military officers in the area, and the Secretary General would like that number enlarged to 75. He called it discouraging that the government of Croatia and local Serbian leaders appear to have turned down key elements of a plan for a larger peacekeeping force. Millions of gallons of treated sewage is now flowing from a ruptured underwater pipe into the ocean off the coast of San Diego. Officials say it could take 2 months to make repairs. Wanda Levine of member station KPBS in San Diego reports.
San Diego city officials say they believe natural forces caused at least 19 sections of San Diego's underwater sewage disposal pipe to break apart at the joints. The San Diego County Health Department has indefinitely quarantined 4 miles of coastline, saying the water is a health risk to swimmers, surfers, and divers. San Diego city officials have declared a local state of emergency, and in an effort to speed up repairs on the 9-foot-wide concrete pipe, are calling for a massive water conservation effort. The 16 communities who use the sewage treatment plant are being asked to help reduce the flow of sewage through the damaged pipe. City officials say they have no way of shutting off or diverting the flow of sewage from the wastewater treatment plant. For National Public Radio, I'm Wanda Levine in San Diego.
Productivity of non-farm workers went up 1.1% in the fourth quarter of last year. The government says it's the fourth straight quarterly increase. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Some novelists pride themselves on the epic sweep of their fiction. Nicholson Baker is just the opposite. He finds it heroic to take one thought, one obsession, or one moment, and follow it in all its minute detail. His first novel, The Mezzanine, catalogued all the thoughts one man has on his lunch break as he goes up the escalator after buying a new pair of shoelaces. Baker's recent memoir, You and I, confessed to how he constantly measures his life and work against John Updike's. Baker's books always include the most intimate, often embarrassing thoughts, but his new novel, Vox, is about the most intimate, potentially embarrassing subject of them all, sex. The novel is a 165-page-long conversation between a man and a woman on a 900-number phone sex line. They're arousing each other with their fantasies and discussing the images and language that turn them on. Now Baker is doing interviews about the book, and I asked him if it's a little embarrassing to talk about.
Well, it is a little embarrassing. The neat thing about the book is that it's a completely private interchange between these two characters who are entertaining themselves by sharing fantasies and undergoing this mutual seduction. And the transaction really between the reader and the book is the same sort of private experience. So the publicity part of the experience is a little in opposition to the whole carefully enclosed world that I tried to create.
Was it ever embarrassing to be writing about sex, or were you ever inhibited or very self-conscious during the act of writing?
Well, and it was a wonderfully exciting book to write because the two characters were each creating contexts in which they could mildly shock each other. And when I would find myself writing my way into that moment in which they would decide or wouldn't decide to use a certain word or would pause before they used a certain word, I really had a kind of eavesdropper's delight there.
So in a way, you were going through the same process that they were?
Oh, I was following them very, very, with much interest, yeah.
What was the germ of the idea for the book?
Well, I had a number of things I wanted to say about sex, but the problem with literary sex books is that you're reading along and you've got these nice social nuances and everything, and all of a sudden you fall into this ditch, which is the sex scene, and you've got the age-old vocabulary and the same situations, and then you're out of it and you're back to social nuances and things. And I decided to expand the ditch, and have the whole book be a sex scene and kind of sprinkle over this very narrow focus all the social perceptions and things that I thought I could get in. I wanted all the rest of life to be implied, even though the characters were trying to stick to the subject.
Do you want to sexually arouse readers?
I want it all. I want I want the book to do all the nice things that art does, to make life seem worth living when you're reading it. And one of the physiological payoffs that a book... I mean, books can make you laugh and they can scare you, and I'm certainly not a horror writer. And they can, with luck and some concentration, they can be sexually interesting as well. And I think, why not have that added plus to the experience, or at least have it as an option?
People look down on pornography, but I think in a way it would be thrilling for a writer to know that they were having some kind of physical effect on a reader.
Yeah. It is a neat idea that you could write this book and then it could be in everyone's hands.
Sexual literature is judged differently than any other kind. I mean, people tend to measure it by whether it turns them on or not. So is that the way a lot of readers are judging your book now, letting you know that, you know, what scenes turn them on? It must be a very different kind of response than you're used to.
Yes. The interesting thing is that women seem to like this book slightly more than men, and men and women like different scenes. All my books were experiments in trying to find out whether these things that I had thought, and in this case that I'd put into my characters' minds, were things that other people would recognize. And so the fact that they are telling me that X or Y was of some mild stimulatory, if that's a word, value, is very much part of the whole experiment.
Well, okay, let me stop you there. You're saying that your books have always been experiments in seeing if certain thoughts are thoughts that other readers will respond to. Just to expand on that a little bit, it seems, too, that the books are experiments in seeing if certain thoughts that you have are universal or not.
Yeah, and especially in this one, where the things I'm saying are so private and so, you know, sexually charged and all that, are the fantasies and ideas that this pair of characters have, are they something that people will say is really kind of awful and unfamiliar? Are they going to say, yeah, that's the way I think too? I don't know.
So how are you feeling now that people are starting to read it? Are you starting to feel like, yes, my thoughts are universal, or, gee, maybe I'm really sick?
I think I'm feeling pretty normal at the moment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist Nicholson Baker, and his new novel is called Vox. And the novel is about two people who have called a 900 number and are spinning out their sexual fantasies to each other. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nicholson Baker, author of the new novel, Vox. This book is in part about masturbation and about being aroused by descriptions of sex as opposed to sex itself. Do you think that sometimes it's more arousing to masturbate or to read about sex than to actually engage in sex with a partner?
Well, from a pragmatic standpoint, it's nice that the characters have to use complete sentences, because I'm in the business, you know, my solemn duty as a novelist is to finish all my sentences. But we're just surrounded by pornography. You know, it's an astounding explosion of stuff all around us. And the book is interested in finding out how we actually use these things. I mean, how we file the images away and what pieces of them we arrange to entertain ourselves. And I guess the fact that this man and the woman are talking about them and trading them back and forth, just for the time being, makes it a more intense, less, I guess, physically distracted moment than it would be if they were actually having sex. Now, I think in a way this book is a love story, I mean, in a twisted way, and that maybe eventually they might have a cup of coffee or do something even more bolder than that. But for the time being, they're just creating word pictures for each other.
I think one of the interesting things about just creating word pictures for each other is that you're not in a real bedroom that probably should have been vacuumed yesterday and thinking about how you have to do the laundry in a few minutes.
On the other hand, it's so important to have the laundry implied. I mean, these two characters...
Yes, it was implied in your book. Yeah, go ahead.
They have to be believable to each other, or the whole thing just, you know, kind of disappears into nothing, unless they can convince each other that they are really doing and thinking the things that they're thinking, the whole spirit of trust breaks down. And so I wanted it to be a kind of realistic use of fantasy. Fantasy with the laundry, you know, and with the less cliched elements of kind of, you know, lingerie and that kind of stuff. I didn't want... I wanted it to be anti traditional sex and yet dependent, or anti-traditional sexual images and yet dependent on it.
Some people have interpreted your new novel, Vox, as a book about safe sex because it's two people having phone sex, you know, talking to each other on a 900 line. Do you see it that way?
I think they're doing something that's pretty risky and dangerous. Of course, they're physically safe. They're not going to get some horrible disease. But they are having the conversation of their lives. These aren't people who would do this normally. This is a pretty unusual thing for them to do, to call up a phone sex line, and then they happen to meet this kindred spirit and talk and talk and talk. And they're spending hundreds of dollars telling everything to someone they haven't seen, and that's emotionally dangerous, I think.
In researching your book, did you try phone sex? Did you try a 900 number just to see what the experience was like?
Well, I certainly didn't while I was writing the book, and I this book really is a fable. I mean, this is a hypothetical situation. What if two folks like this called one of these numbers and happened to meet? What would they really say, and what turns would their conversation take? Afterwards, I called a little bit to see if it was technically possible for the two of them to switch into a private one-on-one connection. But really what the book was based on is my sense of how conversations operate and my also my reverence for the telephone and for the way it narrows things down and forces people to think carefully about what they're saying.
Why do you think the telephone does that?
It removes all those nice things like Baroque hand gestures and fancy cars and nice clothes, and it is a form of telepathy. Even a radio show isn't that close to two minds interpenetrating because it's public and other people are overhearing it. But the idea of being connected by this thin filament from your living room to someone else's living room has always been, I think, a sexually charged thing. It isn't a result of AIDS or any recent development that's made it exciting. It's always been exciting.
This is probably one of the few books about sex in which not only are people just talking about it instead of actually participating in the act, but the woman has a raging yeast infection and wouldn't be comfortable actually engaging in sex even if she were in the same room with the person. And I wonder how you see the yeast infection figuring into the story.
Well, it's one of the things that she's able to say, and it's almost erotic because it's not erotic in that she... If she can say that she has a yeast infection, she must be telling the truth. I mean, the more reason that he has to believe that what she's saying is really true, the more real the products of her imagination are.
I had asked you earlier to read a passage from your book, and you explained that you weren't really interested in reading it because it was kind of very, like, intimate, personal language that was supposed to be about an intimate experience, the intimate experience about writing it or reading it, or the intimate experience about talking to somebody on the telephone. But you're going on a reading tour. What exactly are you going to do on the reading tour if you don't want to read from the book?
Well, that is a serious problem.
I can imagine.
I did not want to go on a reading tour. What I'm doing instead is writing something in the next week and a half that I will read aloud, that will maybe bear in some way on the experience of writing the book or whatever, or maybe not. But I think it would be a major mistake. The idea of an audience sitting and listening to somebody say aloud this stuff is just at odds with the way the two of them are communicating. So I really couldn't read it aloud.
Well, Nicholson Baker, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
And good luck on that tour.
Thank you.
Nicholson Baker's new novel, Vox, is published by Random House. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what are you doing on All Things Considered today about the presidential campaign?
Well, you know, Linda Wertheimer has gone up north in anticipation of the New Hampshire primary. Today, she goes across the state line to Vermont to a free clinic to talk to a couple of doctors there about what kind of health care policy they would like to hear proposed by the administration or arrived at in Washington over the next year. Did you happen to notice in the New York Times today, there was a story about President Bush at the Grocers Association convention, seeing, it seems for the first time, an electric barcode scanner that you see at a supermarket checkout counter?
Yes, it seems like he hadn't been in a supermarket in around 10 years.
Well, it inspired us to apply a regular guy test to the other candidates in the race. We try to find out just what normal things have been normal for them in the past few years.
Okay, well, thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There never used to be rockers who were middle-aged, but now rockers who began singing in the 1960s and 70s are older, and they sing about things like mortality and world weariness. Rock critic Ken Tucker has been listening to two new releases by veteran rockers, Robbie Robertson's Storyville and Lou Reed's Magic and Loss.
Life's like Sanskrit read to a pony. I see you in my mind's eye, strangling on your tongue. What good knowing such devotion, I've been around. I know what makes things run.
Lou Reed's Magic and Loss is a carefully wrought song cycle, 13 tunes about suffering and death, sung in the flat speech song that makes all of Reed's music sound simultaneously urgent and languid. The specific disease that Reed has in mind is cancer, but it's clear that he wants his words to stand as metaphors for AIDS, or for any slow, painful, inexplicable death.
I see the sword of Damocles is right above your head. They're trying a new treatment to get you out of bed. But radiation kills both bad and good, it cannot differentiate. So to cure you, that must kill you. The sword of Damocles hangs above your head.
To compose a rock and roll suite about subjects this serious and depressing is a brave gesture, and Reed is the sort of experienced, articulate artist who might have brought it off. He certainly did last year when he and John Cale released Songs for Drella, a tribute to Andy Warhol. But I think Magic and Loss is a failure, because for all its rumbling passion and sincerity, it's also a pretentious bore, the work of a writer who's never quite gotten over his college poetry classes. Reed never tires of telling interviewers that years ago he took some of those classes with the poet Delmore Schwartz. But on this record, Reed throws together images so disparate, so clashing, that his old professor might have given him a solid C-. Take, for example, this attempt to make connections between the specifics of a disease and one of William Butler Yeats's most famous poems.
So a great man turned into a little child, but cancer reduced him to dust. His voice growing weak as he fought for his life with a bravery few men know. I saw isotopes introduced into his lungs, trying to stop the cancerous spread. And it made me think of Leda and the Swan.
Reed's album is getting a lot of attention. New York critics in particular are solemnly faithful to the cult of Lou. Robbie Robertson's recent release called Storyville caused much less of a stir. It's no more of a masterpiece than Reed's record is, but its subtlety and shrewdness deserve more than the short shrift it's received so far.
Thank you.
gone lost in the crowd, the waves of people in Chinatown. Can't get behind this mystery. Do you believe everything you see? Just a shadow in the streetlight, just a shadow on the wall. A silhouette facing the darkness. I've been waiting for your call. We'll go marching in the night parade.
That's Night Parade. Storyville is a kind of song cycle, too. One about the exotic yet thoroughly American culture of New Orleans as seen through the grateful eyes of a world-weary Canadian. Robertson, who carries the weight of once having been the leader of the band as heavily as Reed does his membership in the Velvet Underground, has attempted to lose himself in those New Orleans streets. He wants to forget his past and forge a different, dreamier style of music, and sometimes he succeeds.
There's gonna be a change of season. Indian summer, look around, and it's gone. Why you wanna save the best for last? We grow up so slowly and grow old so fast. We don't talk about forever. We'll just catch it where we can on the way along. If I grab on to the moment, don't let it slip away out of my hands. What about now?
There are many florid moments on Storyville, lots of hard-boiled cliches in the lyrics that are slightly embarrassing to hear coming from a middle-aged rocker who should know better. But at its best, when Robertson plucks a delicate guitar line and sings in his most intimate croak, Storyville avoids the easy irony and cynicism of Lou Reed's record and becomes the work of a pop artist who is mature in every sense.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Magic and Loss by Lou Reed and Storyville by Robbie Robertson. Our show was produced by Fred Landerl, Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Roberta Shurrock, with Joan Tuohy and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the life of a made man in the mafia. Nicholas Caramandi rose to the top of Philadelphia's mob, but he became a chief government witness in the trials that broke up the city's crime family. Now he's in the Federal Witness Protection Program. He'll join us by phone. In the studio, we'll have George Anastasia, who covers organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.